this show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Hey, gang. Welcome to Indie Comic Book Noise, episode 372. I lost count there because I think the episodes where I wasn't there aren't canon. I'm Steve Raker from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Kevin
Wolwax
and Phil and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit, and we've got Billy Z, Bill Zanowitz.
Hey! Well,
rounding out our round table here. I've said before, we don't do guests on this show, and we don't. We only do friends, so now you're here and things are being done to you.
Okay.
Bad things.
I didn't know I was in for that, but okay.
Bill's an old friend from the boards on the 11 o'clock comic forums, and we've crossed paths at many a con, and fortunately probably got to spend the most time together most recently in at this year's Baltimore Comic Con.
Right.
Which was fun. And Bill is also the host or co-host of his own set of podcasts, Comic Book Bears and the Thundercast, which are they both on Earth 2?
They're both on Earth 2 Network, yeah.
All right. Well, they're
I totally lied. Comic Book Bears is on Earth 2. Thundercast is not.
Okay. Phew.
I lied.
And, okay, we're all liars here.
And you've also have some comic book writing work that you've done in some of the sort of extraneously EOC community-related anthologies like the King Bone Press guys' books, right?
Right, yeah. I've had stories that appeared in three figures prominently, in Low Concept 3 and in Banthology 3.
Cool. And I'm going to press you for what you're doing next in a second. But we are the podcast, I should say, that is sponsored by nobody. But we are thankful to the Deliberate Noise Network and to Derek Coward, the Grand Poobah, for helping us put this show on. And for those who aren't familiar, we're the Marvel Noise guys, but this is where we get to talk about the indie books we're reading and cuss and talk about things that are more appropriate for indie culture. We do have a Facebook page and Twitter and all that good stuff, but like I said, we're not used to having people come on. We get a lot of requests for coming on to talk about projects and things, but Bill is a friend, so the opportunity to have him on under any circumstances is a luxury, but knowing that he has his Kickstarter going on right now, it was the perfect opportunity to have a reason for it to be beneficial for himself as well. So, Bill, you've got a Kickstarter. I'm not going to take away all your thunder by describing the whole Kickstarter to you. I'll let you do that. But it is the Crime Fighter Inquiry.
That's correct. It's a project that I am writing with art by Mark Parman. Mark might be known in some circles best as the writer and artist of an online comic, Grizzly and the Bear Patrol. And it actually premiered. There was a prologue that appeared in the aforementioned Low Concept 3. And, you know, you hit circumstances. Low Concept was 2013, right? Yeah. And, you know, you hit circumstances where real life gets in the way. I don't have to mention that to some people knowing some of the recent history. And we just kept delaying the project and delaying the project until finally we had a clearance where, okay, all this noise is out of the way, pun intended, and you know, we're able to move forward. So the Crime Fighter Inquiry, we're planning it as a 6-issue miniseries with black and white interiors and color exteriors. And it tells the story of Lou Gianetti. And Lou is a middle-aged divorced father of two who leads a fairly unspectacular life. That is until the death of his grandfather sparks a series of events that totally alters his world in ways he could have never imagined. And in dealing with his grandfather's estate, he learns that his grandfather actually led a very different life than he had assumed. And in part with this journey of discovery, he finds that for a short time in the late 1940s and early 50s, there actually were costumed heroes on the streets of a few American cities. This didn't happen in major American cities. It happened in smaller cities like Wilmington, Delaware, and Walla Walla, Washington.
So it gets to be like, or sort of mythologized in
exactly. It's in... essentially forgotten history. It's there if you dig for it, but if you don't know to dig for it, it's as if it never happened. And there's some reasons for that. And Lou discovers what led to these costumed heroes' sudden disappearance. He finds out the role his family members played in these events, and that there were ramifications, most importantly, which last to the present day. And what transpires in the Crime Fighter Inquiry is a story. It shifts back and forth in time and place from, as I mentioned, Wilmington, Delaware after World War II, to the Playboy Club in Chicago in the 70s, to various locales in the present day. And hopefully, if I've done my job as a writer, you will encounter some action, some mystery, and a little bit of humor.
You know you had me at Playboy Club, right?
Okay, good. Glad to hear.
and I would say all of that in six issues, but you reprint or posted, I should say, the short that appeared in the anthology in the Kickstarter, in the description of the project. So you can read that first. And in just those, I forget how many pages it is. I want to say six or seven pages or something along those lines.
You hit it right, six pages.
It goes as, it already tells just about everything you just described. It moves quite fast. So I could see you actually do a really nice job in shoving a lot of info in there and moving it along and still having it, be a tight little, I love, from going back to the old Stan and Jack and Steve Ditko days, I love the short story and all the fun that goes into trying to jam everything into those shorter little pieces, and you move it right to that point of already sort of making that discovery and him being what, like I have a feeling it's not going to be three issues of setting up that he's a divorced father of two before something happens, so that's cool.
Well, thank you. I have to say that in getting involved with this, and this was really, as you had mentioned, the 11 o'clock comics board. I'd done writing in the past as a playwright, but I had never attempted something along these lines. And sometimes getting pushed is a good thing. I will say that now that I have, at least for myself, three issues written under the belt, it is so much easier writing long form 24 to 30 pages than six pages. Oh my God. To encapsulate that and tell everything you want to tell, but in a more economic fashion, and especially what we had to do with, which was, present the baby step into the main story. That wasn't that easy. And I'm glad I did it. I think I'd be better at it if I ever encountered doing a short story again. But damn, those short stories, they're tough to write.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is my third one under the belt. I've also had a story published in a LGBT collection from a group in New York called Geeks Out, called Power, and that was a four-pager, and that was, it didn't take 4 minutes to write, that's all I can say.
I mean, it's why all those short stories back in the day, partially because the creators were all publishing all different kinds of stuff and they were all overworked, but they became so formulaic because it just makes it a lot easier.
Right. And, and whether it's the O. Henry twist at the end or another mechanism, I have so much of a bigger appreciation for artists, because with artists, it's so tied into this. I mean, it's really amazing how quickly Mark and I developed some synergy on this. But for artists and writers that did those short stories in House of Mystery and House of Secrets, or, backups, Adam backups and Action Comics that were five, six pages long, I have such a new appreciation for that particular talent. And and I'm glad I don't have to do it right now. I'm glad I can do longer stories from this point on. And again, that's why we're doing the Kickstarter. We're trying to fund the first issue and hopefully from there take it to its extension, which we see as a six-issue miniseries.
Yeah, I think Alan Moore in that book he had about writing comics talked about getting a start doing those short stories was like the real proving ground. Because, in England, they tend to run those anthology ones where you're always doing these real quick stories and how you had to get really good at paring down to the absolute minimum you needed to get in and get out.
Absolutely.
And I won't bore everyone with going through the list of what your different tiers are and stuff in the Kickstarter, but you've got everything from digital to full immersion in the project.
Yes.
as offering. So definitely go and check out the Crime Fighter Inquiry on Kickstarter and see what's there. And at the very least, you get to read a free short story that is complete yet also very intriguing enough to makes me want to read more, which is cool because I was going to back this in on some level anyway, just because you're a pal. But at the same time, it's very interesting because knowing that, like us, you're from the Foom generation, so you're an older fellow as far as the comic readers are concerned. So to be writing a story that has this legacy piece and that connection, it's like when you start becoming concerned with your family's history. Mm-hmm. And start realizing that you yourself are a caretaker of it, and if not you, then depending on how big your family is, then who else? Like, who's gonna keep the family record and keep the family secrets and know what they are in order to pass them along and be the appropriate caretaker of them, and then to turn it on the superhero genre, I think is going to be fun.
Thanks. And I think you hit on something that I did want to push, that even though this is from the outset, again, the first image you see on our Kickstarter page is something very super heroic, but that's not all that this story is about. Again, I'll just reiterate, if you enjoy stories about superheroes in a very traditional sense, there's something here for you. If you enjoy books loaded with conspiracies and secret societies and hidden histories, then there's something here for you. And as you also touched on, if you enjoy books about the bonds of family, I think there is something very strong that you can latch onto. If that's something that is within your wheelhouse. So
this doesn't sound like fluff, Bill.
Oh, I'm hoping that is not the case. I really am, because I gotta say, like I said, I'm from the Foom generation. It's easy for us to be hacks. We know what works in a sense, and I'm hoping that I have put together something with some weight and some complexity, and I can't tell you how excited I am that we have reached our goal. We are at 100. What are we at? 135%? 127% right now. But, again, we still have a number of days, 19 to go at this point, at the time that we're recording. You can still contribute. And, again, the more money we get in the till, the more effective we can get.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't exactly reach with a big goal. I think it was smart. You kept it small just to try to get the first issue and to, cut into the costs of being able to get it out there. At a discount to shops and stuff, so you could sort of try to level the playing field a little bit as far as getting opportunity to get the book out there. So really everything over just helps really make that happen and be able to get the next book out and stuff.
For
sure. And this show will come out quick after we record, so I think there's still over a week left, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay,
right?
Great. Right, and apart from Kickstarter, you can access it from, we have a Tumblr page, we have a Facebook page, we have the .com, but it's not working for some reason, and that's going to be my project tomorrow night, and you can also contact me through Twitter at Bill Zanowitz, or on Facebook through Bill Zanowitz, and I'll give you all the information you need to do, need to have on hand to get moving on this, and there's also a video with myself and on top of an apartment building in Brooklyn, if you want to see what I look like and just sound like. And that's our Kickstarter. And I have to say, this is, I think, my fourth podcast where I'm talking about this particular project, and I don't know how I'm wired, but I could talk about this project for ages. So
well,
if you have questions, throw them at me, man.
If you get more issues and you get six books out there, you'll have lots to talk about. You can definitely come on, and once the ball's rolling on them, and there's other ways and vehicles you're using to get it out there other than the Kickstarter, come on again, and we'll talk about it.
Oh, thanks so much.
You're gonna kickstart it just because you think we're a real podcast.
But this is like Carson, so you got to stay on the couch and be on the show for the rest of the show. So
Okay, I'll make way for Ally McGraw and whoever else is sitting next to me. Okay, there we
no,
go.
No, it's even worse. It's Canadians, Bill. You got it. It's Canadians.
Hey, this is an awesome day for Canada.
Let's hear from you guys up there. What have you guys been reading? Either one of yous.
Go ahead, Kev.
Oh, he always throws me onto the scene. Well, you know, with Halloween coming up, I can't limit my Halloween stuff to just one episode.
Understood.
Exactly.
Fair enough.
I gotta bring it just about every week. So I have some crazy, well, maybe not so crazy. It depends how crazy you like your comics, your Japanese comics. So I have Cat-Eyed Boy, Volume 1, by Kazu Yumezu, I'm guessing. I don't know. But the reason why I got this is because he was the author of Drifting Boy. Drifting Boy. Cat-Eyed Boy and Drifting Classroom combined. That would be weird.
Oh, I remember.
But I think
when
I mentioned
Drifting
Classroom before, which was another good Halloween type of book that I should revisit, where a classroom with all the students and teachers gets brought to another crazy wasteland world and they're trying to survive, and it went Lord of the Flies pretty fast.
That happens in Mexico, I hear.
But this is Cat-Eyed Boy, which is about a boy that has, like, cat eyes, but humans or demons or other supernatural things, they don't embrace him. So it's an excuse for, like, an anthology where he's, like, going from house to house, finding places to live, and he has, like, weird abilities that help him to survive. But he wherever he goes, he seems to run across, like, some kind of crazy horror story or something that's going on.
Is it yes. House to house, all in the same like neighborhood kind of thing, or is it like, you know, different towns and stuff that he's going to?
Pretty much anything.
Okay.
I was going to mention the packaging on this too, because it has like the, you know, the flaps on the sides, and it has sort of the crazy colors. Like it has the blues, the pinks. They're not scared to use all the, I don't know, not really shocking Halloween colors, but, you know, different stuff. Because it's all black and white, so it kind of sticks out the cover. But the when you open it up, it says, shocking, even your blood will freeze. And then they have all these crazy creatures. I don't know, like, I haven't finished this because it's like 500 pages. Oh, but I'm part of the way through, but it has like all these crazy creatures on the inside, like Lady Monster, the Man in the Wall, Lady Smoke, Tsunami Summer, Insect Man, the Swindler, the Shadow Boy, the Monster with 100 Hands, and like Cat-Eyed Boy is only one of the characters it shows here. So I'm wondering if all these different guys will show up in this.
So you're hundreds of pages into this thing and you haven't gotten to the monsters yet?
Well, there's some monsters, but not like all these monsters. Because the first story sort of introduces you to the Cat-Eyed Boy, and you sort of run across like crazy doctors and zombies and stuff like that. And it's kind of a traumatic story where like this crazy messed up zombie like guy is chasing this kid, and you find out like later on like this guy that's chasing the kid could be his father. But he wants to get away from this crazy man. So the kid actually ends up forcing this guy onto the tracks, and the train hits him, and like body parts and blood are everywhere and everything. Now, so of course, when this guy comes back to life later on, and like different body parts are all like swarming around too, trying to reconnect to his body, the kid's like, oh, I gotta save this guy if he says he's my father and everything. It's just really, really weird stuff.
Now it sounds closer to Drifting Classroom. Wild.
And then you have a sort of mad scientist in like the second story where he's trying to put animal and human parts together. Like he puts the human brain in a leopard body and then the switching things up and everything. But it's not working quite as the scientist wants.
Oh no, what could go wrong, right?
Yeah, I know. But the reason he's trying this out is because this it gets into this whole story about this kid that's like really ugly. and like everyone calls him a freak, and there's like, you know, witch hunts and everything. So so his father like wanted his brain switched out. So like this crazy scientist will find another beautiful like person that's like about to die, so he can somehow switch the bodies and everything, and like the ugly kid will go into the grown up man's body, and I'm like this is a little nuts. And usually things don't work out well, and the cat-eyed boy usually has to come in and fix things up or do something, but he's not the nicest one either. Like, in one of these stories, he runs into one of these, like, zombie supernatural creatures, and he's just like, oh, I want to see what's going on here. So he's like, always spying on people, and then he's like, well, it seems like the zombie's awake. I'm just going to piss on him, maybe see if he's alive or not. And I'm just like, what are you doing? Like, this weird stuff he does. And he also has these, like, abilities. Like, he gets captured by a supernatural, too, because, you know, he's not friends with them either. Because they think he's weird. He's like, they think he's a monster, and he's, you know. It's like, you're the monsters, guys. I'm not really. But anyways, he can, like, with his mouth, he can, like, tunnel. So he can get out of prisons and stuff like that. So it's perfect for Halloween, I would say.
Oh, wow. So it's not a cat-eyed boy, like, will he ever win type scenario. He sounds like he's a little mischievous himself.
Yeah, well, I was wondering if he was just going to be like a narrator, like a crypt keeper type of thing, but he gets involved in the stories, but he doesn't know everything that's going on in every story.
All right, Phil, save us from your impression that all that you guys read up there is manga.
I don't read any of that shit, you know that. Well, I've been saving this comic since it came out. I didn't know the concept, and I didn't know anything about it, but I've been collecting it since day one, and I collected up to 10 issues called Birthright. The reason why I collected it so much is just because the covers were so amazing.
Yeah. Oh. I just heard John Luttrell from Burnt Wieners was just talking about this book
Good
on his
things,
recent
I hope.
Podcast.
It basically what it is it's a story like, if you take something like Goonies or Neverending Story, it's what happens to the characters afterwards when the story's over.
All the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, this one, it begins... Well, it's by Joshua Williamson and Andre Breeson, who's an amazing artist. He's one of my favorite artists right now. His, his covers are amazing. The artwork's amazing. Just really detailed and clean, perfect for this type of comic. But basically it starts out, it's a family of four, two young boys, and the father and the youngest boy are playing catch in the woods, and the ball goes into the woods, and the boy just gets lost. So he's off on like a Goonies type adventure or something like that. Then it goes to a year later, and the kid's been missing this whole time, and he comes back as an adult. And this whole time the father's been blamed for, like, they accused him of his death, stuff like that. So the whole family's broken apart, and he was basically in this kind of magical world and stuff, and he's back here to, like, kill some wizards, and no one believes it's him. And it's just this amazing, amazing kind of road trip type comic in the first arc.
So with that mm-hmm. as the premise, what's on the covers that makes it? Is it the colors? Is it a dude walking with a, you know, stick with a sack over his shoulder? Like, what kind of...
Well, like, for example, like, issue number 4, it's just three of the characters around a campfire, but it's just the way it's drawn and colored. Like, it just looks amazing.
Neat.
Like, you guys really need to check out this comic. I know there's 2 trades out right now, and the third arc's just about to start in November. And, it's my favorite comic right now, probably.
Huh.
Joshua Williams,
yeah,
pretty much
on Comixology.
Does I love? Oh, is it? Is it free?
It probably was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I feel it's something you guys would all enjoy too.
I'll definitely check it out. Andrew, what's going on?
Yes.
3 hours earlier.
Have you guys heard of Guardian Knight Comics?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Neither had I till Bob Breetal, he's at Comic Spectrum and has the Comic Spectrum website, as one of the guys down here, and I met him at Long Beach, and he gave me Gears and Bones number one from Guardian Knight Comics. And I know our bitter, hated rivals, Earth 2, mentioned some of their other titles.
Wait a second. I think Earth 2 is invading this episode.
No, it's just the proper Earth 2 that we have our war with currently. Gears and Bones number one.
This all happened while I was gone.
Created by Alfredo. Alfredo Apple de la Fuente. Art, Oswaldo Montos Montpellier. Script, William Thomas, Andrew Anderson. Colors, Wes Hartman with Tony Galvin. Like, this is like a whole village building this one. The reason why it was given for me is the cover features a anthropomorphic rabbit with a what appears to be a like flintlock musket type and a vicious looking blade in his hand.
Nice.
So, you know, people know I'm a sucker for these sorts of rabbit based comic books.
Yeah, and this you have one a fetish out. For animals. We know what it is.
Well, particularly rabbits, but this one starts out in a fantastical kingdom, and I actually like the mix of, like, I'm trying to place the time, like, the problem is in the real world, when firearms came into being, it seems like knives and maces and stuff got folded out pretty quickly, you know what I mean? But I always like in these kind of comics where they keep the two weapon systems coexist a lot longer than I think history would generally have it. So generally speaking, it's mostly swords and axes and unrealistically sized hammers. But our roguish rabbit on the cover, it's a world with all sorts of different creatures. And one city is, in fact, on the back of this dragon. They've built this whole village. And he's your, you know, pirate, wandering, wastrel guy. You know, like, if you've read any, basically open up the middle of Savage Sword number 97 or whatever, and that's where you are, except instead of Conan, it's a big rabbit. And he gets kidnapped by the local authorities. You know, one of them's this lizard guy. And, you know, it's all sorts of different, you know, they never have just one set of animals. And he's being beat up and tortured for his information. And then his crew comes and bails him out. And then at the end, you find out the big twist is that this guy is not just some wastrel rogue. He's the son of the king. You know, again, there's nothing in here that's going to blow anybody's mind as far as, boy, I didn't see any of that coming. But it's a really fun world. And what I like about it, for a company I've never heard of, the art, I would say, is on par with anything you're going to find at, you know, any of your larger indie books. You know, I have a fondness for all types of art types, but this would slot right in at your Image, your IDWs, your Boom, you know, any of those types of places. In fact, it'd probably be a parcel sight nicer on some of my Dynamite books if these people took over. But I just have the other thing I liked about the first issue, $1.99. Don't know if that's stunt pricing or not, but this has indicia saying August 2015. I'm a little bit behind on my new comic book buying for a variety of reasons. And I'm not sure if my store is carrying Guardian Knight comics. But if you see Gears and Bones and you want to see a giant Jax meets Conan, to use some Marvel references, check it out. Super Steve, for you.
Speaking of Dynamite, I'm not used to talking about a lot of their books, but I did read a couple of series that were sitting on the pile for a while that I wanted to get to because, I don't know, do any of you guys like the old pulp characters that, you know?
Sometimes I'll pick them up. Depends.
Well, not necessarily the comics of the pulp characters, but just the pulp characters themselves that used to exist in the old radio dramas and the pulps.
I like The Shadow.
Yeah.
I love those radio dramas. I can listen to them, The Whistler mm-hmm. and The Shadow and all that stuff.
Yeah, I'm in that bracket too, Steve.
Yeah. I'm a sucker for those guys. At least, I mean, I'm really reverent of comic book history and of characters' history and the continuity and of companies and the handling of characters and where they went and how they got to where they are today and if they still are even around. But I was always digging on the history stuff, even as a kid. So thinking of the pulp characters as the forefathers of the, you know, heroic adventure, the modern heroic adventure story in the urban setting, you know, because those heroic adventures have been around forever, obviously. But to see them brought back and they've been handled, you know, positively and negatively and most oftenly sort of just neutrally, where it doesn't make much of a blip on my radar. And I did check out the Masks limited series that was 8 issues from Dynamite that ran from 2012 to 2013. It was written by Chris Roberson, and the kickoff issue was painted by Alex Ross, who also painted the main covers for the rest of the series, although there was a slew of variants because it's Dynamite and not the opportunity for different artists to draw these characters. You know, I'm sure people were eager to do so. The other issues, 2 through 7, are drawn by Dennis Calero. And he's one of those guys who, I mean, sometimes he can get really moody and tight and almost be like in that family of like Jay Lee type, noir type art. And other times he can be real inconsistent. And this was a variety of everything, I think. And it didn't really hurt, but it certainly wasn't, it didn't make me go wow either. The Masks, the idea of this is that it gets a whole bunch of the old pulp heroes together. The Green Hornet and Kato, the Shadow, Zorro, the Spider, the Black Terror, Ms. Fury, the Black Bat, and the Green Llama of all characters. And the concept is that there's this Justice Party, this political party, with their armed Gestapo-like task force, police force, and they win the governorship of New York State and are vying for controlling the country using their political leverage, and the Gestapo is sort of immediately sent out and making its mark throughout the state. And it's just, I mean, it all happens way too quick, and it's way too crazy of a premise that it would all go so bad so quickly, but it is a premise that allows the heroes to sort of get together and be really desperate and all that sort of business. And there's kind of a Watchmen twist revealing the identity of who's behind it all. That's sort of interesting. There's this nostalgia feeling throughout, but it was a typical Dynamite book, right? And then Masks 2 came out, the new limited series, and that's running currently right now in 2015. It's got 7 issues on the shelves at the time of this recording. I don't know if it's also just going to be 8 issues or not, but it's written by Cullen Bunn this time, and he's done, I think, given a tighter adventure that I'm enjoying quite a bit more. The art is by Imen Casillos. I like the art way better too than in the first one. It's more consistent, more interesting, better sequentially displaying action and stuff. And it starts off real straightforward that there's this like red death enemy with deadly gas, which is so, you know, 40s. And beyond that, the character's also messing with the time stream. So the pulp heroes get caught up in it and it gets really wonky. So you get multiple iterations of some of these characters that we know. So again, I was tickled again by seeing the history of it. We get to see the Kevin Smith version of the Green Hornet with the female Kato, along with the classic version, you know, and there's like 3 or 4 different Ms. Furies, and the Shadow there's only one of, which is cool, and the Spider's at the center of all the time travel. Covers are by Butch Geis, and Jay Lee and Gabe Hardman have been doing the variants, which is really nice to see Gabe Hardman's Shadow and etc. And to see Kato and Kato kicking ass together and them all fighting in these big melees, plus it's got the cross-dimensional angle. It's silly, but it reads a lot better than the first one. And for those who again, just kind of check in with some of those characters now and again, I'd say that the Masks 2 is actually safe. And it shows. I mean, Cullen Bunn's writing that new Shadow book that I think is quite good also, the solo title.
Yeah, I actually bailed on...
What'd you say, Bill?
I would say I actually bailed on Masks 2 after the second issue, and that was more economics than anything else, and it sounds like with some of the developments that you're talking about that have happened in there, I might want to return to that now.
Yeah, there was a big switch around where it's like, oh, really? They're going this way with all the crazy time travel-y stuff. It's bizarre. Like, I don't know how it's going to end satisfactorily, but because it starts off as a street-level kind of story. But, yeah, it's silly fun. Big, dumb fun. All right, Bill, what do you got?
Well, I have a book that I think Mr. L.A. Rabbit might be into, given and this was not planned at all, at conventions that I've been to recently. And that's one downside about going to so many conventions, because you only had 2 weeks apart from Baltimore and New York Comic Con. The one thing you don't do around convention time is read comics. There's no time to do it.
Exactly.
So I'm just starting to hit the piles of stuff that I accumulated at those shows. And the first book, this one I want to talk about, is a book called Stabbity Bunny. And there are two issues out right now, and the publisher's name is buried here somewhere, but the writer is Richard Rivera, and the artist is Dwayne Biddix. If you are happy with Umberto Ramos' style, there's a lot here that you would find familiar. It's a good fit for this book. And Stabbity Bunny tells the story of this young girl, Grace, who's 12 years old as the story starts. And she has been given this stuffed bunny that has been in her family for over 100 years. The bunny talks to her and says that its name is Stabbity. Okay, so it's had different names over time, but now it's Stabbity Bunny. And the action in this takes place, it's one of these books where the environment is as much a character as any of the individuals. It's a town called Holiday, Vermont, and there's something a very ancient evil that you can feel is about to overwhelm that town, and it looks like it's down to Grace and her plush bunny to stop it. it's really funny because it's, you know, you look at the cover and you think for a half second, oh, this is an all ages book. Then you get, and there's nothing that's so scary for children, but it is a very complex tale. The thing that I really came away appreciating is the narrative style in issue one is completely different from issue two. Yet it doesn't feel like a jarring change. But if you step back, it's like, whoa, Richard and he applied a very different template from issue one to issue two. Issue two introduces the big bad effectively, and one of the two covers is a fantastic tribute to that old Joker cover from the mid-70s with Batman against the playing card.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And all of these characters are just, as you're being introduced to them, there's so many question marks hanging over them, and it's almost like the better aspects of something like Lost, you know, that sort of unraveling history where you aren't off put by it, you're more pulled in by it, that you don't know everything right off the bat. There's mysteries about Grace's mother, there's mysteries about Grace's grandmother, who are characters of close friend of hers who's a bit of a an anti-bully, let's put that way. I hate using one particular word, but it's it really pulled me in, and I really don't know where this story is gonna go, and that's one of the things that really really, you know, when I can say that means I'm in for the long haul. So it's Stabbity Bunny by Richard Rivera and Dwayne Biddix. And you can go to stabbitybunny.com if you want to check it out. There's preview pages and all sorts of stuff. And right now there are two issues with a third issue that's about to come out really soon.
And it's black and white or color?
It's color.
Wow.
Cool. And it's nice color. It's really, the colorist is Liesl Buenaventura, and just it sets itself off because there's in some very, very dark events that happen, particularly in the first issue, there are color choices that seem off the wall, but as you get into it, it's completely appropriate to when you are talking about whatever happens that one of the protagonists is a plush bunny that doesn't say anything to the world except for this girl. So yeah, it's a color series, and I really liked it. And stabbitybunny.com.
Huh. Whacked. Kevin, try to top that.
Do you want to join Sex Coven?
Yeah, Sex Kevin or Sex Coven?
Well, one's the title of the book. The other one, I don't know. I guess we could create one of those. I don't know. Possibly. Maybe.
I'll stick with the former.
All right.
At least until after the move.
That's right. So this is published by Youth and Decline. It's Frontier number 7. So this is, I think I got a few other, like, of these Frontier books before, but they're just usually by a different creative team every sort of issue. Sometimes they're, like, translated works. Sometimes, like, I don't know, like, I think they went pretty international. Like, I have one where it's, like, some German comics were translated. Like, stuff you usually can't find. But this one, I don't know. It depends. Depends how you're into how big your indie radar is, I guess, if you would know the creator. But Jillian Tamaka is for issue 7 writes a story about this MP3 file. Like, there's this music file that goes out on the internet, and they don't really know the origin. And, like, the story just starts, well, this file was uploaded on a certain day, and you know, someone comes across it, and the whole story is just about the things people do after they listen to this thing. And it starts back in 1996. So it gets kind of into some weird territory, where someone will like find it on the equivalent of like Napster or something for the story, and they'll be like, oh, well, this looks cool, I'll just download this, an untitled music file, and then they see that it's 6 hours, and I'm like, well, that's weird. And then they start listening to it, and it's like, they try to describe it in the book, but it's like this, they say, well, it's not really words, it's these different sounds, and it makes you feel all these different things, and all these different people, like, listen to it or go run off into the forest with their friends, and they're like, yeah, we're just gonna listen to the song for hours and hours, and they're so into it, like, they'll just be walking through a forest, and then they'll come across a road, and they'll get hit by a truck, and their friend just keeps on walking, doesn't even pay attention to them. So, like religious groups and, like, parents and everything get concerned. Like, they're concerned about this file, and then, like, other research is done looking into the different sounds. Like, they start thinking, well, maybe it's on a certain frequency that is disturbing, like, the brain of youngsters, because it seems like people over 25, like, can't hear it. And so they're saying, oh, it's only if you're young at certain frequencies. Like, it's a pretty interesting story about all these different people and what happens to them. And the artwork goes about things in some different ways. Like, it's not always just straight panels. Like, the illustration of sound waves or the research into sound waves. So you get all these, like, different either musical symbols or, like, computer symbols for, like, what you might be doing. Like, they have all the, you know, sound bars or graphs and charts and as people are researching. And the second half of the story is sort of focusing on this group that was really into discovering what this weird sound file was all about. It sounds weird, but really interesting. It's three colors, too. It's like blue, white, black. So, or I guess technically one color, but anyhow.
It's sort of a square. Like, it's not a traditional comic size, but it's still stapled, and you get, it's like a cardboard cover and glossy pages.
Huh. Weird.
How you turn three colors into one, by Kevin.
Well, I'm just saying that you know how comic retailers are. You can have, like, two or three colors, and they'll still call your comic, like, black and white.
Right.
So,
well, I think it's more what the printers call your comic as far as whether it's black and white or color.
I don't know. It's weird. The comic industry has so many, you know, weird hang-ups about things.
Phil. All
right. I got just kind of two quick hits, or one hit, one miss. The first one is I Hate Fairyland by Scotty Young. It's his first creator-owned comic. Did any of you guys pick that up?
I did, but I haven't read it yet.
Oh, it's awesome.
Okay, I was waiting to hear because while I like Scotty Young, I feel like just looking at his variant covers, I've gotten quite a lot of that.
Well, his art is perfect for this type of story. And basically what it is imagine like Alice in Wonderland. She gets stuck there, and so her mind ages, but her body is still a little girl. So by the point in the story, she's pissed off, and she just loves killing things, and it's just her, like, tearing apart Fairyland, and it's, I think he does a really, I don't know, is this his first time writing, or he's done some short stories, I think, eh?
Yeah, he's written.
I imagine.
Marvel work.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, he did Wonderland, didn't he? Did he write that? Or adapt it?
No.
The Rocket Raccoon and Groot thing, didn't he? Did he write that?
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, he did Rocket Raccoon, that's right. But yeah, it's a really fun book. I highly recommend it. And the other one I have is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 50. I read Ninja Turtles from about 1 to 20, and I really liked it a lot. And then I fell off for some reason because I was waiting for the trades and forgot. And so since then, I know Donatello died, and that's about it. So this one is basically, it's a double-sized issue, and it's their big end battle with Shredder. And like I said, I love the comic at the beginning, but this seems like such a big change, like it almost like it's more of a cartoon-type comic now. And like it was really dumb because there'd be a page where it would be Michelangelo getting his chance against a bad guy, then it would be Raphael's turn for a page, like it was always like that. And the same thing with Shredder. They would each get their page and then like it'd be Splinter's turn. Like it was really, really bad read, I found, compared to what it was before. I guess you don't read it anymore, eh, Kevin?
No, I'm working my way through the series and I like it more. Like I'm at City War, I think.
Okay, I won't spoil it for you. Donatello doesn't come back.
Master Splinter is dead, killed by Mousers. Sorry about that.
But yeah, at the end...
I think my issue with the Turtles at the beginning was the artwork, and then once...
Well, I like the artwork.
Once they bring in, like... I guess it's a few arcs in, they bring in some different artists, and... I don't really want to disrespect the original guy, but the other guys that come in, they're significantly better than who they started off with. So I was just like, wow, that really it takes everything to another level. It's just incredible.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't like this clean, cartoony look that they do now. I preferred the darker look.
I also didn't like the... Who's the guy? The cat guy, but was it Old Hob? Like I didn't really.
Oh, I don't like some of those new characters either. Or the fox.
Yeah, fox like bro. Some of those There's characters early on, I was just like, why should I care about these guys? And then as the story goes on, they sort of build them up, and I became more interested.
Wow, a lot of anthropomorphic animals on this episode, huh?
Yeah.
Andrew, where the sun's still shining.
Barely. How about Wolves of Summer? Another Kickstarter.
Go for it.
All right, but this one you can get via Alterna Press, I guess. But I got it through Kickstarter, and Wolves of Summer is the website. I shot it around a little link to you boys if you're
yep.
got that open on your Skype to give you a feel. It's an interesting dimension. It's a reminiscent of First Second, except it's wider. But so imagine like your regular comic book width, maybe a hair smaller, but just an inch shorter. So it's kind of an odd shape to it. Not that that affects anything. It's just one of those weird... I'm always curious why people choose whatever sizing they choose. If that's just how it comes out, or they designed it from the beginning, or whatever. But it involves... it starts, which I'm presuming is going to be research, but I don't know. I'd never heard of this. These werewolves, which were the sort of rabid group of the Hitler Youth near the end of the war. So that these really young boys that were trained to be sort of saboteurs and that way, as you know, the Russian and U.S. fronts advanced, they would create havoc. And so it's a weird, their specialty sabotage, their motto, hate is our prayer, revenge our battle cry. So it starts with a small group of them in 45. And they're these killers, but they're also still little kids. So they have that weird mix of like kind of Lord of the Flies-y, but also weird little boys at the same time. Yeah, but they still, like, one makes little faces behind the other's back. You know, they're not totally gone primal. They're still acting. And then it forwards to what happened to one of them, you know, 30 years in the future. So it tells those two tales kind of concurrently about what happened to that little squad and then sort of the wreckage of what's left of the guy that gets out of there. And the artwork, now this one is very indie comic book, scratchy, black and white.
It seemed like Zipatone or something.
I think having the book in my hand, I would say no.
Okay.
You're right. There is tone, but I don't think they're using Zipatone anymore.
Yeah.
But I have this nice little sketch in the inside cover. I don't remember what caused me to back this Kickstarter, but it's a fun story. Like I said, you have to have that indie sensibility because you're going to notice that along with the scratchy black and white, some of the facial expressions work. The proportions are not always strictly according to Hoyle. So if that's going to be something that's going to stick out for you, you'll want to avoid it. But assuming you slide into that genre, it's certainly an interesting meditation on this little group of like what happens when you sort of turn these little boys into these things. But like I said, I like how he still keeps them like they seem kind of like little boys. And when he's grown up, he's a total train wreck of a person. But there's tons of process stuff in the back, too. Like interviews with them and bonus comic and everything. So if there's, you know, it's this big fat packet. I don't remember what it cost, but I was very impressed that I got this huge book and a little sketch inside the cover and all that for whatever I paid. So check it out. What I also like is having the website. You can take a look and see and be like, oh, yeah, that's something I can vibe to. Or, no, I don't like that type of artwork.
I don't find the artwork really offensive. Like,
well, but that's the type of thing I think that would put off. Like, if you're, say, a big two superhero dude, I think the kind of that might not be your taste. But maybe I'm being unduly harsh on people that just read big two superhero books.
And are dudes.
I just want to warn them ahead of time because nothing worse than... I don't want anyone that's particularly hesitant. I would rather they have pleasant indie comic book buying experiences because I know from friends of mine, you know, that used to buy a lot of stuff out of Artist Alley. They got burned a few times. Look, it happens. You get books and they don't strike to you. And sometimes they never go back. So.
All right. I got a book to bring the show home with that goes way back to the mid-1960s. I'm going to take advantage of the fact that Bill's here, guys.
Uh-oh.
And a nice collection from IDW came out in 2014, and it is The Best of Wally Wood, Thunder Agents. I just love the Thunder
Boy,
Agents.
You're speaking my language, okay.
I never get to talk about Thunder Agents, and Bill's here, and I don't think I knew before Baltimore that you did a Thunder Agents podcast, or if I did, it went in one ear and out the other in the past, and I was like, oh, I love the Thunder Agents. And I recently, just because of it being a nice oversized hardcover, flipped it open and gave a read. And basically what it is, it's a reprint of Wally Wood's Dynamo stories, most notably that whole first bunch of stories that introduces the whole Thunder Agents concept. And for those of you younger and healthier than myself, you may not know that the Thunder Agents in the mid-60s, 1965, I want to say, Tower Comics, was it?
That's correct, Tower.
Yep. They hired Wally Wood, as a studio to sort of completely produce a finished product comic that then they would, publish. So he was in full control of, right up through editorial of kind of producing it and handing it off to Tower, if I'm not mistaken. And we get the likes of, lots of great Wally Wood artwork, Gil Kane, Steve Ditko, Dan Adkins, although in this volume it's all the Wally Wood stuff with a lot of Dan Adkins inks and whoever else was hanging out in Wood's studio. Occasionally I think, is that a little hint of Tony DeZuniga or some other, I see little hints of other artists in there that are funny. But God, it's the great Dynamo stuff. It's like Cold War action. The Thunder group is a clandestine United Nations defense force, a la Marvel's S.H.I.E.L.D., and they have their super-powered agents. And the series starts off with their headquarters or one of their secret scientific installations, research and development installations, being ransacked by the enemy, and it takes all their good stuff except for a couple of items, and that's what they use to power their superpowered agents, Dynamo and No Man and Menthor and Lightning, I want to say is
later on, yep. Yeah, Lightning.
Yeah. And the villainous is the Ironclad Iron Maiden at first, and Wally Wood's girls say no more. And then she reports to this warlord, and so they're kind of doing this whole, it's got a whole James Bond element of the Bond versus Spectre, and they're sort of always trying to chase down this other faction. So, and there's all these other Bond scenes too. When Dynamo comes to work, he has all these interactions with the secretary, a la Bond and Moneypenny, that kind of stuff, and he comes to work in a suit and answers to the boss, and he gets sent out on his missions, and he's Dynamo, where he can turn the dial on his belt and become stronger and increase his mass and stuff with a big lightning crackle that he can do repeatedly to scare away dinosaurs and stuff at one point. But through reading the series again, having also recently reread Shaolin Cowboy and Hard Boiled, the old Frank Miller and Jeff Darrow work, it really hit me how much of Jeff Darrow's stuff is influenced by Wally Wood. The car crashes into Dynamo while he's standing strong, and it shatters ridiculous spectacularly around him. That's so Hard Boiled. Dynamo arrives on an island, and he's got to fight his way through an army of men, but he does it all in one panel. And it's one image of him with this, all these bodies all over the place, and you just don't see that type of stuff. Back in the mid-60s, someone taking the time to delineate all of that, especially when these books were oversized. Wood was, tasked to, all these Thunder Agent issues had multiple stories in them, and they were oversized issues. Really cool, and rubble all over the place, a la Jeff Darrow type stuff too, and these things are hallmarks of Wally Wood's art, but you forget because you see so much of the modern stuff, and then you see some of these poses, and you're like, oh yeah, holy cow, such good stuff.
Yeah, the word always was no one could throw a punch like Gil Kane, and I think Wally Wood kind of surpasses him on some of the Dynamo work. His action scenes in that series are just, they're things we take for granted, I think. I think they're poses and stances we take for granted.
Sure.
And it's some of the best superhero art I think anyone will ever see, whether they know it or not.
It's really exciting stuff.
And yeah. The whole series is, you know, with Stan Lee introducing soap opera into comics, this took it a bit, you know, maybe one step further with, you know, there's some really, you know, off the wall things that happen in the series. You hit on the bureaucracy, that these are heroes that essentially do this for a paycheck. You know, there's you can't even say, you know, that it's implicit. I mean, there's explicit suggestions that there's sexual relations between heroes and villains as the series goes on. Characters die and they stay dead. There's the U.S. propping up governments and they get into the politics of it. It's a really, really unique series, which takes, you know, a lot of the best elements of the Silver Age, and again, you know, twist that into, you know, what really was happening with the Cold War. And it's, I'm always glad to be a preacher for this series. And I actually don't have the Wally Woods book, and I should.
It's a nice collection, and it's got, you know, the thing with No Man, like, he is a consciousness within clone, like android like bodies. And but there's only one cloak of invisibility, so he's got to be sparing as to which bodies he, you know, chooses to let be eliminated and sacrifice. But it's pretty crazy to see.
Always being reminded that they cost money.
Yeah, well, in the mid '60s, to see a character like fighting his way across a battlefield, getting shot up, and say he's getting shot up and, like, you know, struggling to get to, you know, the target point to do whatever. And he's got to give Dynamo his belt. But, you know, it's crazy to see characters getting riddled with gunshots and dying on the battlefield. Or up in outer space, there's a thing where they're up in a satellite and the bad guy's there and No Man's there. And No Man just takes a gun and shoots the control panel and blows the whole ship up, but transfers his consciousness out of there and sacrifices the body. And it's so super spy-ish, but at the same time, it's stuff we weren't seeing make it to the page. I thought there was going to be a whole alien angle to it also, that the warlord that the Iron Maiden answers to had these alien-type features, but they turn out to be the subterranean race. And there's this whole thing of this, like, subterranean race wanting to get back at the surface dwellers, and totally crazy. There's an issue with dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs are running amok. And at the end, they're on Dr. Sparta's Tropic Island, and they don't even get into it, but at the end, Dynamo's like, well, what'd they do with the dinosaurs and stuff? And the you know, the guys in the office, or maybe it's Miss Moneypenny or the equivalent. I forget her name. She's a little cute brunette. The secretary.
It's Alice.
Alice, that's her.
Yeah, who's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, but she's a cutie. I love brunettes and wearing red. She always wore red. But she mentions that the dinosaurs on Dr. Sparta's Tropic Island were getting turned into a wildlife preserve. And like a tourist park, and Dynamo just turns to her and says, oh no, a dinosaur zoo? And it just ends there. And it's like, this is in 1966. They were basically giving away the whole idea of Jurassic Park and all that and never following up on it.
It sounds like Thunder Agents could be my thing. I don't think I've ever really read any.
Oh my God. If you like if you like Wally Woods art at all, it's a great you know, ticket in to be like, well, let's check out some more Wally Wood stuff that I haven't seen, and then be like, whoa, this is great, because the characters are so cool.
Right. And if you want to sample it on the cheap, IDW, as part of the 100, I always forget the different companies with their different dollar comics. The 100 Penny Press is the one for IDW, and they have the digital version of the first issue for 99 cents. It's also in print, but that's it's half of the first issue. Which was 64 pages. As Steve had said, these were giant books. And that's a great way of sampling it to see if it's in your wheelhouse.
Cool.
I've also been a fan of the Thunder Agents over the years, just because, like, all the different iterations as they popped up over my lifetime from the original, because there was such a big... It was almost like Interview with the Vampire to the later Anne Rice stuff, where there was, like, 10 years in between... but it's like 10 years when I was like a kid. So it was like once I read the original, all of a sudden, like the next thing was happening right in my wheelhouse of a time. And that's kind of the way it was with Thunder Agents. I don't know how you originally came across them, Bill. I want to hear.
I think the same way you did was in the 80s. There were a couple of series, and the one that I was first aware of, because I was away from comics for a couple of years in high school, and then got back into them right at the end of high school. And the publisher was Deluxe Comics,
yes.
And there was a version of if you go into the legal battles about Thunder Agents, that's that's a rock opera in and of itself. But there was a publisher, Deluxe Comics, that put out 5 issues called Wally Wood's Thunder Agents, and with great talent, George Perez, Steve Ditko, Dave Cockrum, Steve Englehart, really top-notch names attacking these properties. And that really was my introduction to them, and then I worked backwards to the stuff that had come out sort of kind of through Archie, and then previous to that from the original Tower Run.
When I was 5 in 1975 and getting into comic books and already reading thanks to comic books, my cousin down on Long Island gave me a big box of comics, Silver Age stuff, Christmas 1975. And in there was, I think, 4 or 5 issues maybe. One of them might have even been coverless of the old original Thunder Agent stuff. So I was on board right from the beginning of my comic reading, of knowing that these things existed out there, but then not hearing anything of them for, 6-7 years until that Deluxe stuff came out again, which was so exciting, and then being like, oh, cool, other people know about this thing, too. It's not just me and Perez and all these. And I realized, oh, this is a thing where people really respect this work big time. And that's where I sort of learned of the historical significance of it. I haven't read all of the iterations of them, but some of the recent stuff that even DC did, where it was like Mike Grell was doing some of the Dynamo, and I'm a sucker for Mike Grell. I really enjoyed some of that stuff. I'm always a sucker for the Thunder Agents.
Yeah, and there was a very recent series from IDW written by Phil Hester, and there are some more plans. I went to a Thunder Agents panel at New York Comic Con, then as press we got to interview a number of people involved in the film project that's been announced, which is being spearheaded by Michael Uslan, who's the producer of the Batman films. The Thunder Agents operate under the United Nations banner, and we got to interview the director of UNICEF because the United Nations is actually tying into some of the future projects. If everything goes to plan, there's a lot of news on the Thunder Agents front coming ahead. And one of our future episodes, actually our next episode of Thundercast, we're going to be playing the interviews that we recorded. Bob Layton also worked on a PSA for a United Nations project involved with the Thunder Agents. We got to talk to him. So there's a lot of stuff brewing.
Michael Uslan actually wrote the foreword in that IDW collection.
Oh, cool. Yeah, he did the same for the DC archives.
And on the credits page, he's also credited as being the Thunder Agents project initiator, whatever that means. So I guess he's really spearheading getting a lot of this material reprinted and out there.
Yeah, he's, as said when we interviewed him, he was a huge fan of it in the 60s. It was like the Silver Age comics that you were getting from DC and Marvel, but just with a twist. And he's been a fan his whole life, and he's real. You can just tell when you're talking to somebody that the enthusiasm is so real, and it's not with dollar signs in the eyes. It's because of a love for a particular concept, and it was great talking to him about that.
There are also a couple of real nice oversized volumes of material just about the history of the Thunder Agents from Tomorrow's, if I'm not mistaken, like a Thunder Agents Companions, aren't there?
Yeah, there's a Thunder Agents Companion, which goes up to, it came out before the 2 DC series that were written by Nick Spencer came out.
All right.
So it basically goes up to that point. And talk about these abandoned projects, Mark Andraeco writing an authority type of version of the Thunder Agents that never saw print, a cartoon that was being worked on for ABC Family. It's a shame that there's more stuff with the Thunder Agents that didn't happen than did. But especially with the companion book, that's one of tomorrow's better books.
Absolutely. And,
yep.
I think it's just because we're partial to the source material.
Yeah. Could be. Can I get a plug-in for what would have been my second book really quick?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, great. Just because this was a real delight that I discovered at Baltimore Comic Con, and my biggest regret was only picking up the first issue and not the other three. It's an all-ages book called A Piggy's Tale, The Adventures of a Three-Legged Super Pup. And it tells the... In real life, Piggy is a three-legged puppy that was discovered during a veterinary campaign in the Dominican Republic. And through surgery, medicine, and lots of love, he came over to the United States to live. And that's real life. And in comic book life, he is a superhero. He's Super Piggy that... patrols the streets and skies of New York City with his companion Simon the Cat, and it's a really wonderful book in the sense that it touches on so many serious topics, yet it reels itself back in enough sense that it would bring you down. His avatar, his guide, essentially is this. Angelic farm pig that met the fate of all farm animals. It breaks your heart to read these things, but then it just goes right into the exuberance and the fun of a dog and a cat being superheroes in comic books. And there are four issues that have come out. I only have the first issue, and I really want to rectify that. The writer is Todd Emco, and the artist is Ethan Young. And you can get that from Bohemian Press. And I think the issues are all $2.99 a piece. Piggy's Tale, and you can go to piggytale.com to find out more information. That is my second recommendation, keeping with the animal motif that is run.
Anyone else have any other talking animal books?
No, sadly, no. It's not a talking animal book.
All right, then let's make that the episode. And you can find us on our Facebook page. You can find us on Twitter at Indie Comic Book N, at Steve Raker, at WWX Kev, at LA_Rabbit1. And Phil is at Me and My Sloth. Bill, what are you on Twitter so people can spam you?
I'm on Twitter as at Bill Zanowitz, but I'm never there. I'm a very bad Twitterer. But we have the Comic Book Bears Twitter, which is Comic Book Bears. And both myself and Comic Book Bears and Thundercast have a presence on Facebook. And that's probably the best nexus to contact me.
And check out Bill's Kickstarter, The Crime Fighter Inquiry. And listen to us over on Marvel Noise. And that's probably everything, right? What I miss?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if we did a Thunderbolts podcast, we couldn't be the Thundercast, I'm assuming.
No. Not We had to
very carefully word our podcast because there was a Thundercats podcast. took the name. So we had to be very careful with how we worded it and prevailed. But yeah, Thunderbolts would have to be something else.
I can't wait to listen to that next Thundercast with those interviews. That should be cool.
Yeah, no. I just hope Bill, they can't with the audio. Yeah,
are you still throwing that up on the Comic Book Bears feed, or do I have to go find a different one? Because I was getting it there.
Yeah, it's still on the Comic Book Bears feed. We haven't had an episode in a couple of months, but we are going to fix that very soon. So
okay, I just wanted to make sure I was still subscribed.
Yeah, actually, I got to say, with the press participation that we had with the Thunder Agents projects that were announced at New York Comic Con, that provided us the perfect reentry point. So a blessing in disguise that kind of got us moving again. And just for people to understand the concept of Thundercast is we actually go issue by issue with each episode. So it's going to take us years to get through the series. But we've covered the first seven issues of Thunder Agents and the first issue of Dynamo. And you can read along as we read along, and hopefully you get something out of it, because we don't take it too seriously, the stories, and hopefully we provide a couple of laughs along the line with Thundercast. So
does this guy know who he's talking to? That sounds right up our alley.
Okay, cool.
That's our MO as well. All right, guys, thanks for joining us. We're going to try to get another episode in before Halloween, and we'll try to get spooky with that one. All right, think outside the box and go read some indie comics. Later.
The tissue box is empty. No coffee for my cream. Dogs howl in the alley. Crazy women scream. Some kids shout from their pickup truck. They're stoned on life and fear. 50 radios playing in this street. I'm still hardly here. Exquisitely born in California. We take our trouble to the caress. Exquisitely born in California. Exquisitely born just like all the rest. When the sun shines, barrels out in space. Pray TV looks like pay TV to me. It's just a curse on the human race. I take a drive up to LA in my gas-guzzling limousine. There's a whole lot of crazy people up there living out a life in sweet ennui.